Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is another episode of the Personal Wealth Coach. Whether or not it's exciting, I guess, depends on how exercised your adrenal glands have been lately. If they're a little bit overexcited for the long term, not much is exciting. And our definition of excitement is generally talking about economics. So it's pretty dreary and dismal science. Most people fall asleep in it. It's, for some reason, been a little bit more exciting lately. I'm in the process of wiping down the studio while I talk, so please forgive me for a moment as I put some very rare and expensive hand sanitizer all over the board and the mouse and the computer. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, which is not just a radio program. I bet. I'm guessing you guys already knew it was a radio program. It is also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm based in Salado, Texas, in the grand metropolis of Salado, Texas. What does it mean, SEC-registered? It does not mean that the Securities and Exchange Commission has endorsed us in any way. They just are the people that we register with, and they are the ultimate authority over what we do. And if you hear us saying something on the not-so-straightforward path, then they're the folks that you should talk to about it. I have, hopefully, this is Jeff McClure, the older Baldy, or as we said last week, because we could go back to that, elder Baldy on 773-1400. Is this you on the line?
This is old Baldy in the voice.
No, all right. I think you need to take it off a speakerphone.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to call you back then.
Okay, because you sound like you're in a cavern.
Well, I am.
Okay.
I've gone into my bunker deep underground, and there's a big room here, and it's all concrete in every direction.
Yeah.
And I brought nothing but toilet paper with me, so I'm in good shape.
Well, the toilet paper should actually be lowering the echo effect. So do you just have it still wrapped in paper?
Well, I keep that in the vault.
Ah, oh, yeah, okay. That makes sense. When it comes right down to it.
Let me try plugging in something different here.
Okay.
And I'll stay on the line.
Hopefully it'll work.
Keep talking.
All right. What we say on here, even though we are the SEC registered investment advisory firm, is still the same name as this radio program, but what we say on here is not investment advice. It may even be construed as advice, but not investment advice. Investment advice is offered only when the specifics of an individual's details on all of their time horizons, risk tolerances, who they are, what they want, all that good stuff is there. What we're offering on the radio program is education. Hopefully information that's been vetted enough. I think people that have been listening to us for very long know that we're not conspiracy theorists, that we really try to rigorously. Oh, no echo. Well done. No, we really try to rigorously get the information as complete and accurate as we can. We get it from sources that we deem to be reliable. I use the word.
You use the redeem word. I love the deem word.
Yes.
You can redeem.
That's the whole point. I mean, tomorrow is Easter, so everyone should redeem the word deem. You had a joke for me on the radio, on the phone on the way in about virtual viruses and so on. Would you like to repeat that?
Yeah, well, I got that from the Temple Daily Telegram today. It says, remember when when church was not virtual and we worried about getting viruses on our computers? When we really went to church?
We're
in a different world. There's no question about that.
Well, you're not getting a virus from church service.
Did you already tell them that we don't pay for the program?
No, that's the last disclosure. You can take that if you want. I'll give you something to
okay,
do.
Okay. We don't pay for this radio program. On the other hand, we do pay for advertising for the radio program on the radio. You can go figure that. Of course, KTM does not pay us either.
They also pay for advertisements for the radio program. So
yes, and they also we allow them to advertise. I shouldn't say allow. They advertise on our radio program, and they have the ability to run ads on our program and receive revenue for it.
Correct.
It's a weird arrangement. The bottom line to it is we're not paying to do this radio program.
Yeah, the idea here, and this is, people ask us why we do this.
I'm not sure.
I can say from a philosophical reason, my wife and I also founded a not-for-profit, a Montessori school. Why would somebody go through that torture of doing something that you're not going to get any profit out of? I think I'm going to get profit out of it, just not directly. I think if we educate people that everybody's going to do better. The more educated people are, the more they know about stuff, whether it's how to take care of horses or how to take care of themselves or how to read, how to write, or how to use their educational knowledge on making better financial decisions. I think that improves the lives of everyone. So it's a very indirect way of giving back, and that's what we're doing. And it's, we often debate. You know, when was the last time we had a good debate about whether or not we should continue to show up on Saturday mornings and talk to phone balls for 2 hours? We talk about it pretty regularly.
The last time we made the decision towards the beginning of this year, I think.
Yeah. It's about annual.
Debating whether we wanted to work on Saturdays.
And it is work. This is something my wife wished for me to say. It's hard work to do this. That coming out here, it's not easy in the good markets, in the good economy, to tell people that bad things are coming. It's really not easy to be a contrarian. And it's not easy in the really rough periods to tell people about the good times that are coming. And that's our jobs. We get to be optimists when everyone else are pessimists, and pessimists when everyone else is optimists. And that sounds very fun, and it's really quite a lot of work. It is really hard when the majority of people agree on something and we take the stance intentionally of saying, we're going to look at it from a different direction. And there's all kinds of psychological studies on that subject. Candid camera, the old.
And we're not doing that.
Go ahead.
We're not doing that just to be contrary.
No.
We're not intentionally contrarians. Just the reality is we have a longer time horizon.
Yeah.
For instance, we're saying very clearly right now that the worst is yet to come. In this crisis, that it's going to go on a long time, and I know that's not very popular.
People want to hear that the end is in sight.
The fact is, until we get a vaccine, any relaxation in social distancing will result in a surge. Maybe it'll take several weeks for the surge to hit, but a surge in deaths. And a lot of people don't like to hear that because the wave of the virus pandemic hasn't got to them yet. You know, it started in New York. I mean, I say it did start in New York, but New York is the epicenter, but it's now moved to Chicago and Pittsburgh.
New Orleans.
It's moved in New Orleans. And it'll move on to other places. It'll hit Houston. It'll hit Austin.
It's already hitting Houston.
Why do I know that? I mean, it'll hit major. You'll see them in the headlines as having high death rates. So, the issue of when does the peak occur? Well, first off, it depends on where you are. And secondly, it is going, if we are successful in flattening the curve, then it will take a long time to get through this. But everybody who is exposed to it is going to catch it in one form or another.
Yeah, because we're,
and we don't even,
we're,
you know,
not,
we talk about the, we talk about the death rate. All I can say is, you know, and I've heard numbers that run all over the place on the death rates. Depends on who is in. We don't know who gets infected yet because we're not able to test enough people.
Right.
But the bottom line to it is, if you read recently the horror stories that were coming out of the New York City area and will soon be coming out of other places where they, and I saw this week videos, obviously taken from a drone, of semi-trailers backing up on Hind Island, or I'm sorry, Hart Island in the New York area, and bulldozers digging huge trenches in their lay, and the semi-trailers back up and forklifts are lifting out these rectilinear boxes that are not shaped like the traditional coffin. They're just boxes or white boxes. And they're laying them three deep in this trench. One after another, three by three by three. They're just lifting them out of the semi-trailers and laying them in the trenches. And then they put a cover, a hard cover over the top of the boxes. And then they, bulldozers come in and bury the dirt and they dig the trench back a little further.
Yeah.
I mean, they bury the coffins and they go back a little further. And we're going to see something similar to that in various places across the country. It's going to hit the cities first because that's where the concentration of people are. And then it's going to start rolling across the rest of the country. And Dr. Fauci said it, I think it was Dr. Fauci who said it very well. We don't set the timetable, the virus does.
Right.
And the more we are spread apart, the more we are distancing ourselves from one another, the slower the spread will be. But it's still going to keep spreading. And until it goes away completely, or we've all had it, or we're all vaccinated, it's still going to be there. And the moment we start clustering together again, it's going to break out again. And problem is, you start clustering and nothing happens. It's 2 weeks before you start to see the beginning of the infection show up. And it's a really hard thing to deal with. I will say this, I was pleasantly surprised at the degree to which we have flattened this curve by social distancing.
Yeah.
Voluntarily.
It is working well if we continue to do it. There's a cost to doing it, and we're definitely are aware of that cost, but there's a greater cost to not doing it. And I think we've got to underline that. And as much as we're saying, we've got a lot of hardness to get through coming out of this on the other end of the valley is going to be beautiful. It really is going to be better than it was. And we haven't covered what's happened in the market this week. We already have a question on the email. It says, it may be too early to tell, but do you think the pandemic is causing new trends in investing that will challenge the classic models? And the answer to that is yes. A lot of times we're the ones that raise the red flag and say, hey, it's not different this time. It's not different this time. And in some ways it isn't different this time, but there's a lot of ways that it is. If I look at the financial models back in 1918, 1919, and I've spent a lot of the week this last week and big chunks of my career going back before that, looking at that particular area, we're following the market from 1918, 1919, very, very closely. I mean, it's just within a very narrow range of difference that we had that steep drop. We even had the same sort of bounces and then the steep upward trend. And the market recovery took place a long time before the economic recovery took place. And that's what the market does. People are saying, how can the market be having a rally like it has when we have unemployment off the charts like this? And the answer is because if you can call it a rally, when you've got record upward movement, it's only, you know, a positive thing if you're back in positive territory, and we're not. I think, you know, you and I talked about this on the phone, that things are different this time. We can talk about that some more. Yes, go ahead. Talk about the market.
Well, the markets were closed Friday, but we only had a 4-day week, but it was an interesting 4-day week. The S&P 500 rose 12% this last week, 12% in 1 week. Now that's in this inflation environment, that is more than it typically rises in 2 years. It closed at 2789.82 if you're following that on Thursday, and it's just an astonishing rise. As a matter of fact, it is the biggest rise in the market in a given week since 1974. So why is 1974 important? 1973 was during 1970, the year 1973, the market fell over 50%. As we entered into 1974, it started the recovery. And there's a lot of reasons for that fall. Oil was one of them. oil prices going in the other direction.
Yes, going up rather than down.
But the important thing was, that it marked the beginning of the recovery. It marked an early stage of the recovery from the market collapse in 1973. Now, does that mean this is a recovery? I don't know. We call it the SPX, the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index, is still down 17.61, almost 18% from the market top back in February 28th, but it's up 25% from its bottom on March 23rd. Now that's pretty astonishing. It's still down 13, almost 14% for this year, and it's still down 3.41% from this time last year. So we would have said in a normal time that a market that has fallen 3.41% in a year and is down almost 14% from the beginning of the year was a pretty bad market. I'm saying it looks like Easter out there, folks.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. And there's some other good news floating around out there in the market. We're reading about corporate CEOs, not just the insiders, but the CEOs are buying stock with true enthusiasm. They're basically soaking up they're taking their cash and converting it into stocks of their own company. There was Mr. Ackman, who is a manager of a relatively famous hedge fund manager that you probably never heard of.
Oh, those that have
anticipated this crash.
They have a hearing of activist investors, what he's often called.
And he saw the crash coming in February, early February, and he put in a lot of relatively simple put orders on major indexes. He didn't put the put orders in on individual stocks as much as he did the major indexes, the S&P 500 and so on. He made a $2.6 billion profit as the market collapsed. The interesting thing about that is not that somebody called it right. He does high risk bets. Matter of fact, because he borrowed money to do it, he literally had over 100% of his investment portfolio in a position where it would benefit if the market fell, and it would take a big loss if the market rose. And he hit it right on the head, and he liquidated in March, and since then has been buying blue chip stocks. He basically is going through the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Average and looking at the companies with deep cash reserves that are going to come out of this, and avoiding the companies that don't look like they're going to make it through it, and has basically reinvested all the $2.6 billion back into the market. And as we wrote in the newsletter, it either is really different this time, or we're going to see some amazing reactions when the reality of the economic situation hits.
Right.
And when go ahead.
I was going to say that we do have some things that are different this time, and we can talk about that soon, but go ahead with what you were saying.
We're hoping that back in March we saw the bottom of the market. I won't make any guarantees. It could be that everybody will wake up and say, this is worse than I thought it was going to be. This isn't the peak. Even if it is the peak, we've got a long slog ahead of us, and get suddenly pessimistic and start selling again. But let me simply say I'm cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, and in the second wave of the viral hit in 1918, we didn't see the market collapse again. It had already been priced in. We might see it collapse again, but I don't think so. And you and I are both cautiously optimistic on that. We are people that in February, and I recommend this to people, go to our webpage, tpwc.com, and listen to some of the past broadcasts. Read the newsletters. Our newsletter in January, in the middle point of January, was saying coronavirus might be a lot bigger than we expect it to be. It will be disastrous if it reaches the rest of the world. And going forward, I mean, most people were not even talking about it at that point. So I'm saying that not to pat ourselves on the back, because there's nothing good about being right about a disaster. I'm saying it to say that we're using the same data to look forward today and say things are going to be better than they are right now economically. We have to get through some tough times to get there. What's different about now versus then? I've mentioned 1918 multiple times here. In 1918, they didn't shut down the economy. Instead, they just let people die. And it was the right thing to do at the time because herd immunity was the only way to do it. And what is herd immunity? Well, everybody gets sick enough that they're immune to it. It's the whole, back in the 1920s, you used to have mumps parties. You knew a kid in town that had the mumps, and you'd get your kids to go over to their house and play for a while so that they could get the mumps before they were adults. So they'd get a herd immunity, and that would stop the pandemic from spreading across everywhere and really wiping a lot of people out. Same happened with measles. They didn't have vaccinations in 1918. And the only reason why shutting down everything and keeping social distancing is likely to work really well is because we will at some point have a vaccination for this. It wouldn't work otherwise. So it is different this time. It's different in a better way. And that's the thing that I keep hearing. It's different this time, but they always talk about how it's much worse. And I'm always a little shocked at that. Much worse than smallpox? What are you talking about? So from that perspective...
It's certainly not much worse than polio.
No. This is not the measles. This is these are things that, you know, they kind of rust in the back of our brains from history lessons and so on. The numbers of deaths that occurred from these things. We are not discounting what we're seeing now. It is bad, but this is nowhere near as bad as it could have been. Not that that makes it better now.
Let's talk about the rest of the market just a little bit.
Okay.
The 10-year U.S. Treasury note, now it's astonishing, only moved a tiny, tiny 4.6 one-hundredths of 1%. And the 10-year note, I never thought I'd see the 10-year note yielding this low, but it's yielding 0.729%, which is just astonishingly low. It's 0.75%. In other words, if you bought a U.S. Treasury note, a 10-year U.S. Treasury note from the Treasury today, paid no brokerage fees, you'd only get roughly 0.73% per year yield on it. And inflation even now is higher than 0.73% per year. So you're in essence paying the United States government for the right to loan them money.
Right.
It's a fascinating thing. Now, but the plus to that is the 90-day T-bill is even lower at 0.231%, which means the yield curve is positive. It's an amazingly low interest yield curve, but it's a very smooth positive yield curve that is, and if you believe in the forecasting ability of the yield curve, which a year ago was forecasting a recession at this point, and it was apparently very accurate, the yield curve is saying a year from now to 18 months from now we'll be in recovery. Now, it's also suggesting that the recovery is going to be a little bit on the slow side, but it's really hard to tell. The yield curve inversion or non-inversion doesn't actually tell us how big or small a recovery or a recession will be. It just says there's going to be one or there's not going to be one. And it's been fairly accurate through history, and it's saying, in essence, the yield curve is telling us that the collective buying and selling of treasuries is saying this has an end to it within a year to 18 months.
Right.
Now the oil market is a little different story. That's crazy.
Yeah. The oil market, if we look back at the 1980s, we could have decades before the oil market recovers.
The oil market dropped, the price of West Texas Intermediate crude dropped almost 22% for the week and closed at 22.76. Now, That was on Thursday, so it was before Russia and Saudi Arabia and now Mexico and the rest of OPEC have agreed to cut pumping, reduce their pumping by a pretty substantial amount. However, I looked at the substantial amount they're going to reduce versus the demand that's out there, and the demand is still lower than what they're going to be producing.
Right.
Not to mention the fact that there are gigantic oil tankers, the super tankers, the super oil tankers, sitting in ports or just outside of ports all over the world right now, full of oil, that has to be sold before we can even begin to start buying, before they can sell the oil that's being pumped out of the ground, because oil goes, it's called sour. It goes sour if it sits in storage too long.
Sweet crude and goes so sour. I don't know who the tasting employee is, but that person should get extra pay.
That's an interesting concept. It is very true. And the point is that we are going to have very, very low oil prices for an extended period of time. And that's not some esoteric item that says, okay, the world oil prices will be low, gasoline prices will be low, yippee. Texas, if it were part of OPEC, producing nations in OPEC, we produce more oil than Mexico does. And Texas gets a lot of its state income, a lot of its educational funding, a lot of everything that runs the state of Texas comes from the fact that Texas collectively owns the oil rights on huge chunks of land in West Texas. And we get royalties off of that, and we, in addition, charge a tax on every barrel that comes out of the ground. And with companies going bankrupt and unable to pay their taxes, and we're going to have to restrict, at some point, we're going to have to restrict pumping, and the price is down, and the tax is a percentage of the sale price. A year from now, Texas is going to be in a world of hurt financially.
Yeah, thank God
we have a rainy day fund.
Right, the state government level. That rainy day fund is absolutely necessary, and it was made looking at the 1980s as its reference point, which hopefully means that we've got a big enough reserve, because the reality is that the state is funded by sales tax revenue, and sales tax revenue for a lot of areas is massively down.
The only bright side to that is Texas was one of the leaders in getting the ruling that Amazon and other online companies have to collect sales taxes as if they were physically present where the person buying them lived.
Right. And I've got some data here that I can show the areas of the economy that are doing better now than they've ever done before, and the areas of the economy that are hardest hit. If you would like me to get in some details there, are you ready for
Go
me
for
to
it.
Switch your, okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to say some things that most people are going to find totally obvious. The areas of the market or of the economy, not the market, the economy that have been hit hardest. They are also hit hard in the market, but everything has been hit hard in the market. From the farthest, the most hit, taxi and Uber driving is way down. Ride sharing of any kind, including the scooters that you see in the big metropolitan area, Bird, Lime, those things, those are down about 100%. Now, about 100% means they're not getting anything. Airlines are down roughly 80% as far as their sales. Amtrak, Metro North, Megabus. The mass transits are way, way down. Lodging is down. That's Marriott, Hilton, Hyatt. There's a lot more of those. Those are the big ones. If you look at fine dining, for some reason, people are not going out for French cuisine in a sit-down restaurant right now, and that's not the sort of restaurant that does takeout. Fitness. So fitness is down about 75%. And that's only because people have monthly memberships that haven't been canceled yet. Otherwise, it'd be down 100%. Just like Uber. If you had a monthly subscription to Uber, they'd be doing a lot better than they are today. Apparel is down about 60%. Charitable giving is down about 40%. Fast food is down roughly 40%. So when we think about auto parts, you would think, well, that could be exempt. No, it isn't. They're down about 30% as far as their overall mobile networks, AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, that sort of stuff. They're way down. People are not using their bandwidth on their phone. They're using their bandwidth at home. Now, let's talk about some of the good stuff. Flip over onto the other side. Supermarkets are, as far as the prices being charged, remaining flat. but the amount of extra revenue coming in is huge. And this is something that the data is not clear on yet. We can talk about percentages on places like Uber because that's really easy. Grocery stores have seen huge spikes in demand. The people that were eating at restaurants are eating at grocery or eating at home from grocery stores. General merchandise and e-commerce, so think Etsy, eBay, Walmart, Amazon, those things, we're not seeing the prices go up drastically there, except on some items that there may be some punishment for going up. If you see masks being sold at way beyond the normal price, that's called price gouging, and there's laws against it, and eventually those folks will be stopped. Warehouse clubs, Sam's, Costco are way up. Online groceries are up about 80%. Gaming online is up about 70%. That's Twitch, Nintendo, Fortnite. You just go down the list. Blizzard, Activision, or Activision Blizzard. I get them mixed. They're one company now. Video streaming's way up.
Activ Blizzard.
Yes. Meal kits. This is one that may be interesting. Alcohol is way up. So home beverages. So if you're ordering the little Keurig stuff, if you're ordering the all of that, make it yourself at home. Here's one that may be a little shocking to people. Office supply stores are seeing a major uptick, about roughly 25% uptick in their sales. Because people have to buy a bunch of equipment and have it delivered to their house instead of their office. And so that's kind of the gamut. We've got a whole spectrum in the market. There's a lot more things in the economy that are down than are up. But the things that are up really, really well. The things that are down are up really, really badly. So you've got these combinations. It's, you know, the question, is it different this time? Well, maybe. We don't have data from when smallpox was spreading. We don't have data from when the Black Death was there. But I suspect they didn't have online retail. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that from an economic point of view, the data that we're gathering today is going to be used probably for centuries. This is going to be a major part of the history books as far as economics goes, which means that most people won't know about it. But it's going to be major for those that do. So that's what I wanted to cover on that subject.
I think all of us learned about the 1918 flu in school. But we also figured that that was a one-off event that would never happen again. And I think that was a collective belief in the United States, except among epidemiologists and Bill Gates and a few other people.
By the way,
Bill Gates in 2017 made a YouTube video.
Not a YouTube video. It was a TED Talk.
Well, it was a TED Talk. I'm sorry. It was a TED Talk where he warned that this was coming.
Yeah.
He warned we need to prepare for it.
And he's saying this isn't the last one that will happen.
That is the hard reality. With globalization, and I don't mean globalization in the sense that outsourcing of jobs, I mean in the sense that we travel around the globe. People take vacations and routinely go to exotic places where they have exotic diseases and then come back. This, we could easily see another epidemic of this nature. Hopefully we'll be better prepared for it.
Yeah, this is some data that's coming out from Johns Hopkins. It appears that most of the sickness that's taken to most of the pandemic in New York didn't come directly from China. It came from Europe. And that it wasn't just Italy. It was Germany and it was the UK and it was a lot of other places. Because believe it or not, there aren't that many New Yorkers that travel back and forth to China compared to Europe. But there are a lot of Europeans that travel back and forth to China or to areas near China where the Chinese also travel. And I can tell you I've been to Thailand and to Hungary as a tourist, enjoying the history of those places. And it's just as likely to see a Chinese tourist as a German tourist, but there aren't a whole lot of American tourists there. Go ahead.
there's a point that keeps being made in the science and in the deep parts of the article that I think people are maybe missing. And that is the majority of the spread of this virus appears to be from people who are totally asymptomatic. In other words, avoiding the first warning we got was avoid people who are coughing or sneezing or whatever. But apparently, this virus gets spread largely by people who have no symptoms, but who have the virus. They don't have a fever, they don't have a cough, but they have the virus, and they're dropping virus particles all over, and they're breathing out the virus particles, and it gets spread that way to people who then have the symptoms. Even in China, they're now finding people who have the antibodies for the virus and who obviously were infected a couple of months before it showed up in Wuhan, and they were not from Wuhan. I mean, there are people from scattered points around China who had the virus and were apparently asymptomatic or maybe had some symptoms. And so we're not even sure if it came from that Wuhan meat market where it was originally blamed for it. We know so little about it at this point. We won't know a whole lot about it until it's all over and we get to look back. And hopefully we learn from that.
Right. Coming out of this, I mean, and we talked about this last week, we'll talk about it again repeatedly going forward, the biotech revolution that's already started based on this, expect the major biotech firms to be disrupted. Just expect it. Coming out of this, Medtronic has done a fantastic job for a long time of managing its prices to stay extremely profitable. They and Eli Lilly and a lot of the other big pharmaceuticals out there have cornered the market in their specific areas. And now there are a lot of innovators that are focused in on this because all of us have felt immune, indestructible to this sort of thing. Our ancestors conquered the viruses. We have vaccinations. We have felt that way, and that's part of why when we learned about the Spanish flu in school, I don't know about you, but when I learned about it, the teacher spoke about it as if it was a never-to-be-seen-again event, that it was an event that now that we're past this, we're past it, and we never have to worry about it again. And that is absolutely not the reality that we face in the world today. We face a reality that is much starker. It was the same reality when they were teaching it to us, but we didn't know it. And that behaviorally, this is one of my, maybe my favorite bias to talk to people about. How does it feel to be wrong? It is a question. And when I ask that question, it's a trick question. Everybody says, oh, it doesn't feel good to be wrong. And then my follow-up question is, then why were you wrong to begin with? And the answer is they didn't know they were wrong. So the real answer to the first question is being wrong feels the same as being right until you know you're wrong. And we right now, right now, we know we're wrong. So let's get right.
Well, there's a lot of people even when they are wrong that don't know they're wrong.
That's
hey,
true. That's true.
We need to do commercials, but we got another email in. But we are accepting emails at either jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, and we will comment on those. You can't call in because we're gobbling up the one telephone line that KTM lets us use, and we probably ought to do commercials.
Okay. I'll play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Again, email addresses are jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff.
McClure. All right. We didn't get it on time because we've got a lag on the phone and between our voices, but that's our excuse this time. Sometimes we just don't get it right saying our own names. Another piece
we
of... Go ahead.
We had an email in, and it wanted us to expand on the comment in the newsletter that the Russian economy is close to collapse and the World Bank is reluctant to assist this time.
Yeah.
Russians have dipped into their policy, into their U.S. dollar reserves in March. Now, this is old news because we get it with a delay on it. And they're denying that it has anything to do with the price of oil. But the last time the ruble collapsed, it was because the price of oil collapsed. And Russians are right now in the position where they're having to sell oil on the open market to get cash. But they're selling it at less than its cost, than the cost it takes to bring it out of the ground and pump it to some place where they can sell it. So they are they are very, very export dependent. They're very, very dependent upon the export of oil. The Russian ruble is down to, it's down about 30% right now, but again, that's a lagging indicator. The Russian ruble is dropping against the dollar and against other currencies pretty fast. There is a distinct risk, not a certainty, but a distinct risk that Russia will see another collapse like it had in 1998. And
right.
That collapse in 1998 was caused by the price of oil collapsing less than it did, than it has this time around.
Right.
Which is, by the way, why you saw them suddenly decide that they were going to cooperate with Saudi Arabia and OPEC and limiting the oil flow. Their stated reason for opening the spigots earlier was to crush the U.S. fracking.
Yeah, the shale world.
Which was causing the price of oil to be low. And they blew it on that one because here's the point. All those rigs are still out there. All that oil is still in the ground. The holes are still there. Yes, the individual small companies that have been pumping the oil out of the ground may go bankrupt, but somebody will swoop in. Venture capitalists will swoop in. They'll buy that stuff up, and they'll start pumping again just as soon as the price of oil comes back up.
Right. Not just venture capitalists. Any of the larger, older oil companies that have big reserves for specifically this reason will be able to buy up those assets at very discounted prices.
And the Russians are the ones who are least able to benefit from this. The Saudis are, even though they can pull oil out of the ground at about $3 a barrel, they have got a tremendous amount of support that they provide for the people who live in their country to keep them from rebelling against the kingdom. And they've got to keep that support going or they'll be in a world of hurt too. And in the newsletter, we make the comment that loud bang you heard on Friday was the Saudis, or Thursday or Friday, was the Saudis and the... And the Russians slapping themselves on the head going, duh. The only people who were getting hurt by that price war were them because, frankly, the U.S. Shale companies would just on the coronavirus with no price war would probably go out of business anyway.
Yeah. The ones that were going to go out of business.
The big companies will survive because they've got the reserves to survive with. And like Jake said, I think they'll come in and buy this up. The problem is... This is how historically wars get started. If Russia collapses, now when Russia collapsed in 1998, we still had hopes of seeing a liberal democracy come out of Russia. They had an elected government. We were ready because in 1991, when the Russian government changed over, we had had a lot of input into creating a representative government. And we were willing and we were in a position to be willing in the United States and the rest of the world was willing to give assistance. And so through the World Bank, the United States and other countries made some very low interest long-term loans to Russia to keep them from totally collapsing, even though the ruble collapsed to virtually worthless at that point.
But since then, they've invaded two different countries
and taken it for their own. We're not in a position where we have lots of surplus that we can lend to Russia. We're basically borrowing like mad to lend to ourselves. This is something to keep an eye on because what happens when countries collapse economically and they still have big militaries is they have a tendency to go grab somebody else's territory and pull the money out of there. It was the depression and the collapse of the economy of Germany that caused them to basically take an elected official and turn him into a dictator. I would not be surprised coming out of this to see a president for life, a dictator named Putin.
Well, that was already set to occur. That particular vote has been delayed a little bit by the coronavirus, but it's going to be improving his odds of winning for dictator for life.
The parallel between Adolf Hitler's rise to power and Putin's rise to power as dictator is fascinating. And basically it was a financial collapse where Hitler put the trains back on time and put everybody back to work, and the only way to pay for that is to take somebody else's money. So Hitler began to invade countries nearby, initially invading the ones that spoke German and liberating the Germans, which, by the way, Russia has already been practicing.
Yeah, Georgia and Ukraine are both the areas taken in both of those countries are Russian speaking.
And so there is a distinct risk here that Russia could militarize this event, and we could see the beginnings of a major war where we have to face down against Russia. And I'm
now let me
at this point.
Can I interject real quick? Don't expect that war to really do anything, or if it happens, if the Russians collapsed, don't expect a war to get kicked off while the virus is still raging. History is very, very clear on that subject, going back all the way to, if you look at the pantheons of gods and their interactions with each other, the god of pestilence always trumps the god of war. God of pestilence will stop the god of war. This is important information. If somebody thought that we're going to have a war right in the middle of this, all you have to do is look at the Theodore Roosevelt, the aircraft carrier, to say it's not a good idea to try to go to war in the middle of an epidemic. Ask Napoleon when he was heading over to take a big chunk of North America, and hundreds of thousands of his troops died in Cuba and in Haiti.
Wait, did you say Napoleon?
Napoleon, yeah. Did you?
I think a lot of people are unaware of the fact that Napoleon actually thought he was going to go take a chunk of the Americas.
Right. He had hundreds of thousands of people in the Caribbean ready to head up through the port of New Orleans and take what was later sold to the United States as the Louisiana Purchase. He was going to take and then head east to the more settled grounds and take over the colonies there. And at that point, it was a very major possibility. We did not have hundreds of thousands of troops to resist him with. There was nowhere near that. He had a significant portion of the population of the existing United States in an army sitting in the Caribbean that was going to head up through an already established beachhead in New Orleans. And that's something most people are not aware of, but the different tropical fevers did him in. Malaria, yellow fever, it just wiped out a huge chunk of his army. And that was the real turning point in Napoleon's wars. This is the reason why later he lost on the European continent, because he sent a significant portion of his army to a place that had a lot of disease, and they died. And if you just look back, Belisarius, who is one of the greatest generals of all time, was reuniting the Eastern and Western Roman Empire when plague hit. We don't even have a name for that particular plague, but it killed him and it wiped out a big part of his army. And it went from a pretty good chance that the Roman Empire would have been reestablished to zero chance in a matter of a month. So that's that. Just knowing that if Russia has a collapse now, they do have a military and they will use it, but it's very unlikely that they'll use it in the middle of a pandemic. Just wait till after the
vaccine. This is one of those slow things. We won't know where the rubble is and where the disaster is until this is over. And we're almost out of time for this hour. We do have another question from Tom, and we'll probably need to address that in the next hour.
Okay. Well, if you would like to talk to us off the air, we actually do give specific investment advice, fiduciary investment advice to people of high net worth. that, well, man, I think it's greatly worthwhile. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing it. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting during the weekend. Real live people are still answering the phones, though they are remote during the week. And the local number is
254-947-1111.
You can reach that number as well at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We've got recordings of the radio program going back quite a long ways. We've got newsletters, and you can contact us there as well. You can also contact us directly through email at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth.